Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I think we'll begin. My name is Simon Goltel. I'm the director of Crash, and welcome you all to what is the Crash series of lectures for this year, partly marking the 10th anniversary of Crash and partly marking our anticipation of moving into the new building on the Sidgwick site very shortly. The idea of the Crash lectures is that we should take a topic of major concern, not just to us, but in general, in social terms, and get some very smart, interesting people of relevance to talk about them. And that's it. And the idea of the university seemed to us kind of important right now. And if I have to explain to you why, you're probably in the wrong room. It's a great pleasure for me to introduce, as our first speaker, Stefan Canini, who's been chosen not only because he falls into that category of the very smart people who might have something to say, but also because, unlike some of us, he's done it on this topic, the idea of the university, with extraordinary articulacy in the press and elsewhere. And it's a great pleasure to be able to introduce him. Stefan.
Thank you, Simon. Good evening, everybody. Well-meaning friends can be a terrible trial. Various people, having seen this lecture announced, have helpfully confided to me their fantasies about what sort of occasion it might be. The briefest way to summarise some of these expectations might be roughly, Cardinal Newman meets Laurie Taylor. Others, I could tell, entertained even more improbable fantasies about tomorrow's newspaper headline, Don topples minister. And one or two, it was clear, imagined something altogether more historic and elevated. We shall fight them in the libraries. We shall fight them in the classrooms. We shall never surrender. Well, I can assure you, it's not going to be at all like any of those. The only brief that Simon has given speakers in this series is that we must address the theme of the idea of the university. It may be worth reminding those of you who recall this as Newman's title, exact scholarship after all, being one of our cherished values, that his title was actually the idea of a university. That is, the particular Catholic university which he was attempting to establish in Dublin in the 1850s. In fact, to be more exact still, that's the shortened title by which the revised edition of his book eventually became known. I doubt that any of you would have been looking to lecturers in this series to produce an updated version of Newman if he had stuck with his original title, Discourses on the Scope and Nature of University Education Addressed to the Catholics of Dublin. But attending to these details does, I think, usefully remind us that all pronouncements about the nature of universities are inevitably unstable compounds of soaring generalizations and taken for granted specificities of time and place. And it's all too easy when addressing the topic of this lecture to make oneself look foolish by converting what may in effect be a series of local accidents into some kind of universal essence. One obvious way to try to avoid that might be to begin by thinking frankly about one's idea of this university. In the 1970s, a book was published called My Cambridge, in which various people who had studied or taught here tried to express what it had meant to them. If I think of having to write such an essay, I realise that My Cambridge would be at once too private and obscure, as well as too general and unlocated, to satisfy any publisher's or reader's expectations. It would be too private and obscure because My Cambridge, as far as it matters to me, consists first and foremost of the domestic life I've lived in a quiet side road of the city. And I'm not likely to add anything significant to Tolstoy's dictum about all happy families resembling one another simply by throwing in a bit of estate agent's hype. All happy families resemble one another, especially if they live in the much sought-after Newnham area. But My Cambridge would also be too general and unlocated, because it simply consists of people who are, in some respects like me, scattered about the city, hunched over desks in faculty offices and college studies and converted back bedrooms, and various shifting selections of us, as I can start in my more expansive moments to think of these colleagues, come together for seminars, meetings, drinks. But my Cambridge seems not to have a very corporate or institutional existence. I must admit, though I realise it may be tactless of me to do so on this occasion, that I'm not a great enthusiast for the high table form of life centred in the colleges, with its flummery, its self-importance, and even now, its preponderant maleness. So mine's a rather abstract Cambridge of the mind. Perhaps everyone's is. It may seem to amount to little more than the relative geographical proximity of quite a lot of clever, learned, awkward, not easily persuaded people whose very existence somehow helped keep me up to the intellectual mark. And of course, where my colleagues and students are concerned, I intend the terms clever, learned, awkward, not easily persuaded to be all equally positive. But that sense, though expressed with deliberate offhandedness, is something very precious and goes back a long way in my life. One of the things I immediately liked about university when I was an undergraduate, and still like about it, was the built-in assumption that trying to understand things was a normal and worthwhile human activity, and that anyone, whatever their age and status, might contribute to it. I can't say, to be honest, that I made much contribution to it when I was an undergraduate. My time was too much taken up with certain other normal human activities. But even then, I did feel that learning about things and trying to understand them more clearly, more exactly, more deeply, was what the place seemed to be about, and not the adventitious features so beloved of the media, such as posh dinners and career networks. A lot of different and incompatible roles are now assigned to universities, as they have always been. But one way to begin to think about their distinctiveness is to say that universities provide a partly protected space within which trying to think the less inadequate thought has priority over any other purposes in a way which it would be madness or at the least very disruptive for other institutions in society even to countenance. I don't for a moment suggest, and I hope it's unnecessary to say this, that good thinking is only done or can only be done in universities. No, but universities are, I think, the only institutions where pursuing such thinking is in principle not subordinate to some other purpose. So that could be, in its barest outline, one idea of the university. And it is, of course, as my title suggests, a quite outrageous idea. It involves selecting a group of people, gathering them in one place, and telling them that they have one major task, which is nothing less than to extend human understanding. That's clearly a challenge which no one in their right mind would accept, hence perhaps the kind of people you tried to find working in universities. But anyone with any sense, it is often said, would surely want to take on some much more intelligible and manageable task, such as making money, or making war, or making the trains run on time. Now, society has various organisations devoted to such tasks, and it's not too difficult to work out what use they serve, if any, and whether they are fulfilling their functions reasonably well. But talking of serving uses and fulfilling functions can be treacherous territory where universities are concerned. So I'm going to approach the relation between these high-flown generalities and the institutions that actually exist, and the circumstances in which, now in 2011, they actually find themselves, by a more roundabout route. In this lecture, I'm first going to offer you a few brief reflections on the history and current state of the institution we call the university, focusing principally on Britain. And I shall then go on to propose a perspective and a vocabulary which I think enable us to discuss the role of such institutions in more fruitful terms than those which currently dominate public debate on the topic. Universities across the world in the early 21st century, it may be said, find themselves in a paradoxical position. Never before in human history have they been so numerous or so important, yet rarely can they have suffered from such a disabling lack of confidence and confusion of identity. At a moment when the number of students currently enrolled in these institutions across the globe is several times larger than was the case only a generation ago, there is unprecedented scepticism about the benefits, both intellectual and material, of universities and a university education. While in some quarters universities are heralded as engines of technological advance and economic prosperity, elsewhere they are attacked for being self-indulgent, backward-looking, or elitist. Now, these tensions take various forms, obviously, depending on local circumstance and cultural tradition. But the sheer scale of university expansion around the world in recent decades indicates that much is expected of these curious institutions, perhaps too much, or at least perhaps not exactly what they are best designed to provide. Societies which hope their newly founded universities will become powerhouses of economic development tend to strike a more upbeat note when discussing them than do those richer Western societies whose long-established institutions fear that the instrumental discourse of modern market democracies is becoming impatient with the traditions of open-ended inquiry, which have hitherto been seen as these institutions' distinguishing feature. Within universities, those in technological, medical, and professional disciplines are generally more confident that the future belongs to them than their colleagues in the humanities or even many branches of the so-called pure sciences. A professor of accounting and business studies in Singapore, or a professor of metallurgy in Wuhan, may understandably feel that universities have never been so popular or so well resourced. A professor of medieval history in Ohio, or a professor of German literature in Sheffield, may feel that their disciplines and their careers have never been so precarious or so little esteemed. Because the huge expansion of recent decades has involved a growth not just in student numbers, but also in range and subject and type of institution, it's too late in the day, I think, to try to be insistently purist about the usage of the term university. For better or worse, it's now applied to a great variety of forms of post-secondary educational institution. These institutions are expected to serve several important social functions, from vocational training to technology transfer, just as they are asked to further several admirable social goals, from inculcating civic values to enabling social mobility. Moreover, not only do universities operate within different cultural and to some extent intellectual traditions, but their relations to their respective host societies and their states vary enormously, especially their financial relations. Practically all British universities, of course, are overwhelmingly reliant on public funding. But while these monies have increasingly come with some tightly drawn strings attached, successive governments have, so far, largely respected the principle of the autonomy of universities as laid down in their charters, leaving them to determine their own internal affairs, including their academic programmes. In many parts of continental Europe, universities, which may be legally obliged to admit any student with the relevant school leaving qualification, are directly under the control of the national or regional minister for education. Such institutions are often seen as direct instruments of government policy, including various forms of social assimilation and the inculcation of preferred patriotic values. While elite education and research is often heavily concentrated in a small number of state-run research institutes or grandes écoles. In some parts of Asia, the Middle East, and Latin America, universities which are in effect wholly state-run technical colleges, specializing in subjects such as engineering and agriculture, sit alongside wholly private institutions, often specializing in economics and business studies, which depend largely on the fees from the children of relatively wealthy families. In our larger meditations on this topic, we tend to speak freely of the university, as though all these various types of institution partook of some common informing ideal or essence. But it's not easy, faced with this bewildering array, to see what this might be. The task is made more difficult by the great multiplication of subjects of study and research. In reality, many universities have long offered courses that went beyond the traditional core of disciplines in the humanities and natural sciences, but there has been a marked expansion of such courses in recent decades. Diplomas in golf course management sit alongside masters in software design. Professorships of neonatal care are established alongside postdoctoral fellowships in heritage studies. In addition, Universities are increasingly centres of the creative and performing arts, as well as hubs of policy advice, while those in countries influenced by the Anglo-Saxon tradition may also be major nurseries of athletic achievement. Multiversity was the term introduced, perhaps only half seriously, in 1963 by the then Chancellor of the University of California system, Clark Kerr, to capture the huge variety of activities now carried on in a major research university, a variety that has only increased since then. There are many things to be said about the admirable University of California system, which has, at least until now, managed to combine the provision of wide public access with the maintenance of at least two world-class research universities. While among the less obvious defining characteristics was the fact, as Kerr reminded us, that it was the world's leading consumer of white mice. In the interest of exact scholarship, once again, perhaps I should say that what he actually wrote was that it was the world's leading purveyor of white mice, but I think we know what he meant. And even if we confine our focus just to universities in Britain, we need to be realistic in recognising what functions higher education institutions in this country actually perform. Overwhelmingly now, they are expected to provide vocational or pro-vocational training. By pro-vocational, I mean courses in things like business studies or technical design, which are intended to prepare students for a general area of employment, albeit not a single profession, in the way in which, say, medicine or social work does. I think the most striking statistic with which I can bring home to you the pace and scale of recent change is to say that nearly two-thirds of the roughly 130 university-level institutions in Britain today did not exist as universities as recently as 20 years ago. And with this expansion have gone dramatic changes in the character of British universities. At present, over five times as many students in British universities study business studies and accounting as study English. Over six times as many are doing courses in practical subjects allied to medicine as history, and so on. And for the most part, the largest numbers of students are to be found in the least traditional universities. Leaving aside the Open University, which is in any case rather special, 18 of the 24 largest universities in Britain in terms of student numbers last year did not become universities until 1992. And I should make clear that I think that such expansion has in principle been a great democratic good, one that we should welcome and support. Also, we have seen a dizzying growth in the costs of big science and the share of university budgets now taken up by science, engineering, and medicine. In the most research-intensive Russell Group universities, these subjects alone account for almost five-sixths of the university's turnover. So when we talk about the nature and purposes of universities, or when we discuss assessment methods and funding regimes, we have to be realistic about these characteristics of the present system. Mass education, vocational training, and big science are the dominant realities and are here to stay. But however important these features are, they clearly are not the whole story and not the answer to the question, what is the idea of the university? And one way, I think, to get these features in perspective is to realise that throughout the long history of universities, there's been a constant tension between the practical ends, which society thinks it's furthering by founding or supporting universities, and the ineluctable pull towards open-ended inquiry, which comes to shape these institutions over time. The very open-endedness of their principal activities threatens to legitimate forms of inquiry that may run counter to the aims of those who founded or supported them. In fact, one begins to wonder whether societies do not make a kind of Faustian pact when they set up universities. They ask them to serve various practical purposes, but if they're to be given the intellectual freedom necessary to serve those purposes properly, they will always tend to exceed or subvert those purposes. Representatives of the lay public, or in the more statist regimes, government officials, may be installed on ruling councils and other superintending bodies, but they cannot effectively regulate all that goes on in the libraries and laboratories. Societies want the scholars and scientists in their universities to extend understanding and discover new knowledge. But those activities have their own logic, which cannot be gainsaid without a risk of jeopardising the inquiries themselves. Of course, in some cases, extreme measures can be taken to prevent research and writing departing too far from the official script. For example, a few professors can be shot pour encourager les autres. But in broadly liberal societies, such measures are frowned on, and subtler means have to be found to manage the inevitable tensions between prevailing definitions of social purpose and the ungovernable play of the inquiring mind. Since universities are in some ways puzzling and opaque institutions, attempts to describe them naturally tend to bracket them with more familiar or more immediately intelligible concepts. Perhaps the most frequent, because the most plausible, misconception about universities is that they are simply a marriage of convenience between a type of school and a type of research laboratory. Now, there are, of course, continuities with these two institutions, but I think it's the discontinuities which are more fundamental and more interesting. One neat, but therefore, of course, only partly adequate formulation famously says that while school children are taught, university students study. Undergraduates are being introduced to the modes of inquiry appropriate to various disciplines. What they develop, ideally, is not simply mastery of a body of information, but the capacity to challenge or extend the received understanding of a particular topic. For this reason, university teaching has more than its share of the paradox involved in telling someone to be autonomous. Learning what is involved in conducting inquiry in a certain discipline partly grows out of being exposed to examples of such work and then being incited, not to reproduce them, but to produce a piece of work of one's own that's informed by having come to understand what the examples are examples of. And this can only be done by becoming acquainted with work in a particular discipline, simply being exhorted in general to pursue truth, cultivate accuracy, express oneself clearly, and so on, will not achieve the desired goal. Now, research laboratories, the other half of that equation, of the kind maintained by some big corporations or by certain charities, especially those that support medical research, do bear a close resemblance to one aspect of life in university science departments. And there's a good deal of trade between the two types of institution in terms of ideas and personnel. But here the main differences are differences of setting and scope, though differences in ethos can also sometimes be revealing. Research labs not based in universities tend to have goals which are fairly strictly circumscribed by the character of their parent organisation. It's true that a large corporation will encourage its most highly qualified research staff not just to refine and improve its current products, but to push against the boundaries of the present state of the field in ways which may generate new ideas and eventually new products. And in some industries, such as information technology or aerospace, some of the most fundamental work may be done in these labs by scientists who might be equally at home, if less well funded, in a university computing or engineering department. Nonetheless, there are obviously limits to the range of work which a corporation's R&D team can undertake, and such focused research programs are always partly parasitic on the more open-ended inquiries pursued in universities. Microsoft or Boeing or BP or other large corporations in highly technical industries may help to advance knowledge in certain fields, but they do not function like universities, and nor would their shareholders look kindly on any attempt to do so. Analogies between universities and quite other types of institution may, precisely because they're less fashionable, be more illuminating. Some, at least, of what lies at the heart of a university is closer to the nature of a museum or gallery than is usually allowed, or than most of today's spokespersons for universities would be comfortable with. The latter would doubtless be afraid that it would make universities seem too backward-looking, which is a damning phrase from the lexicon of right-mindedness, though we might on reflection have to acknowledge that most of what we reflect on and try to understand is necessarily in the past. A facile contrast can be made between the research laboratory and the museum in respect of their relation to time, where the former is seen as oriented to the future and to discovery, while the latter is concerned with the past and with preservation. But this familiar contrast, I think, obscures not just the ways in which a museum expresses a constantly changing relation to human understanding and is the home of all kinds of advances in knowledge, but more importantly, the ways in which any scientific community is embedded in, indeed, partly constituted by, the practices and observations of its predecessors. Moreover, neither of these institutions exists in a vacuum. They require a very extensive cultural infrastructure, including not only the long, drawn-out education required for curators and conservers and researchers, but the wider world of scholarship and science which sustains them. One of the reasons why the question, what are museums or galleries for, can be helpful in thinking about universities is precisely because it reminds us that the answers do not depend just on the interests of the current generation. All conservation, all transmission or handing on, and in fact, all inquiry, is implicitly governed by its relation to the future, a point I'll return to. Neil McGregor, the current director of the British Museum, recently observed that the purpose of such an institution is that of giving people their place in things. And applauding this sentiment, the historian David Wootton added that the purpose of many forms of scholarship is to give the past its place in us. Now, at one level, of course, these self-consciously epigrammatic remarks don't take us very far. But perhaps at another level, they do point to something museums and universities have in common. Something to do with enabling individuals to place themselves in relation to the world, including to time. This is certainly not confined to the humanities. Finding one's place in things could just as appropriately be said of inquiries in physics and astronomy or psychology and anthropology, as it could of those in history or literature or philosophy. There are other aspects of universities that may suggest resemblance to a variety of quite different types of organisation, to think tanks, performing arts complexes and apprenticeship programmes, as well as to sports clubs, community centres and dating agencies. In addition, as we're now often reminded, universities are large employers and one of the chief sources of prosperity for local economies. But all of these comparisons obviously pick up on what are contingent or inessential features of universities, on functions which have come to be appended to their main tasks of extending understanding through teaching and research. So this brings us back to the central question of how best to characterise those main tasks. Almost a century ago, the American social critic Thorsten Veblen published a book entitled The Higher Learning in America, A Memorandum on the Conduct of Universities by Businessmen, in which he declared, "In a general way, the place of the university in the culture of Christendom is still substantially the same as it has been from the beginning. Ideally, and in the popular apprehension, it is, as it has always been, a corporation for the cultivation and care of the community's highest aspirations and ideals." Now, given the larger purpose of Veblen's book, as indicated by his book's critical subtitle, this is really a remarkably confident and downright statement, not all of which we may be happy with. We, of course, are not now inclined to speak of Christendom, though the term may serve as a reminder of the roots of university and even as part of its character into the 19th century. Veblen's language hints that some of this spiritual legacy may still be at work in modern conceptions, since the community's highest aspirations and ideals may seem to go beyond the usual understanding of everyday activities. But what I particularly like about it is Veblen's passing insistence that this elevated conception of the university and the popular apprehension of it coincide, about which I think he was right. Even today, after all the vast changes that have overtaken universities and that separate them from the institutions that Veblen knew, and despite, or at least as much because of, the great educational enfranchisement that has taken place in recent decades, there still lingers this popular conception, almost a longing, that the university should be a protected space in which thought and ideas of this kind can be pursued to the highest level. Whatever the reality of the experience of actually attending one of today's semi-marketized, employment-oriented institutions, there remains a strong popular desire that they should, at their best, incarnate a set of aspirations and ideals that go beyond any form of economic return. It seems to me important that attempts to make the case for universities in present circumstances should not lose sight of this deep and pervasive conviction. For there's an inescapable difficulty involved in any argument that looks like an attempt to justify something. Inevitably, a certain aura of defensiveness hangs about such exercises. The initial presumption seems to be that the value or point of the thing is in question and needs to be defended to a doubting or unsympathetic audience. Those who attempt to speak up for universities in the present nearly always seem in this way to start on the back foot. Certainly in Britain at present, a gathering largely made up of other inmates of universities is bound to have some of the atmosphere of a support group. Perhaps I should have begun in the approved fashion of such groups. My name is Stefan. I'm an academic. But it does not seem to me that those who speak for or about universities need to adopt this defensive posture. In saying this, I'm obviously not forgetting or underestimating the degree of misunderstanding and hostility that universities in Britain have encountered from some quarters in recent years. But I suspect that among the public at large, there is potentially a much greater reservoir of interest in and latent appreciation of the work of universities than this narrow and defensive official discourse ever succeeds in tapping into. In talking to audiences outside universities, some of whom may these days, of course, be graduates, I'm struck by the level of curiosity about and enthusiasm for ideas and the quest for greater understanding, whether in history and literature or physics and biology or any number of other fields. Some members of these audiences may not have had the chance to study these things themselves, but they very much want their children to have the opportunity. Others may have enjoyed only limited and perhaps not altogether happy experiences of higher education in their own lives, but have now, in their adulthood, discovered a keen amateur reading interest in these subjects and want to know more. Others still may have retired from occupations which largely frustrated their intellectual or aesthetic inclinations and are now hungry for stimulation. Such audiences do not want to be told that we judge the success of a university education by how much more graduates earn than non-graduates, any more than they want to hear how much scholarship and science may contribute indirectly to the GDP. They are rather susceptible to the romance of ideas and the power of beauty. They want to learn about far-off times and faraway worlds. They expect to hear language used more inventively, more exactly, more evocatively than it normally is in the workaday world. They want to know that somewhere human understanding is being pressed to its limits, unconstrained by immediate practical outcomes. These audiences, I'm not pretending, are all of one mind, and needless to say, not all sections of society are equally well represented in them. At various points in their lives, too, they may have other priorities and there'll always be competing demands on their interests and sympathies. But it's noticeable and surely regrettable how little the public discourse about universities and contemporary society makes any kind of appeal to this widespread appreciation on the part of ordinary intelligent citizens that there should be places where these kinds of inquiries are being pursued at their highest level. Part of the problem may be that while universities are spectacularly good at producing new forms of understanding, they're not always very good at explaining what they are doing when they do this. Of course, we should also acknowledge that in practice, contemporary universities do not perform some of their distinctive tasks all that well. Not to acknowledge this would be, I think, yet again from another angle, to underestimate the intelligence of the public, who are well aware that all is not well with many of our overcrowded, overregulated institutions of higher education. But the larger problem with so much of current public discussion about universities is the category mistake that is made when we try to justify intellectual activities in terms derived from another set of categories altogether, categories drawn from the instrumental world of commerce and industry. One could illustrate the pervasive nature of this mistake by considering the parallel logic of the following three statements. One, I like going walking in the Lake District because it boosts gross domestic revenue from tourism. Two, I decided to have children because the economy of tomorrow will need an adaptable workforce. Three, it's good for students to read great works of literature because they acquire the skills needed to manage a widget manufacturing company. And talking of literature, it's usually at about this point in the argument that an appearance is made by one of the more bizarre and exotic products of the human imagination, namely a wholly fictive place called the real world. Now, this sumptuously improbable fantasy is quite unlike the actual world you and I live in. Now, in the actual world that we're familiar with, there are all kinds of things and all kinds of different people doing different things, sometimes taking pleasure in their work, sometimes expressing themselves aesthetically, sometimes falling in love, sometimes telling themselves if they didn't laugh, they'd cry, sometimes wondering what it's all about, and so on. But this invented realm, called the real world, is inhabited exclusively by hard-faced robots who devote themselves single-mindedly to the task of making money. They work, and then they die. Actually, in the fictional accounts of the real world that I've read, they don't ever seem to mention dying. Perhaps because they're afraid that if they did, it might cause the robots to stop working for a bit and start expressing themselves and falling in love and wondering what it all means and so on. And of course, once that happened, the real world wouldn't be so special anymore. It would just be like the ordinary old world we're used to. Personally, I've never been able to take this real world very seriously. It's obviously the brainchild of cloistered businessmen living in their ivory factories and out of touch with the kinds of things that matter to ordinary people like you and me. They should get out more. The other main way in which the contemporary university's insecurity about its standing and function is manifested is the heightened concern with international comparisons, especially the obsession with global league tables of universities. Where their supposed findings are convenient, these are readily cited for publicity and propaganda purposes. Yet the truth is, they are practically worthless. On many matters, the data are not available in strictly comparable form, and the reliance on subjective and inadequate opinion surveys provides little information that is both reliable and useful. Moreover, these league tables, as you will know, there are several now in operation, with the Shanghai World Rankings generally receiving the greatest attention. These rankings give disproportionate weight to big science. So the resulting places tell us something about the level of expenditure on research projects in the sciences in the various universities, and that is allowed to stand as a proxy for the more intractable problems involved in deciding whether one university is, in any sense that makes any sense at all, better than another. And the significance attributed to these largely vacuous exercises indicates, I think, the conjunction of two forces which bear directly on the discussion of the role of universities. The first is the glib assumption that universities are locked in combat with each other in some form of worldwide competition, itself a transposition of larger assertions about the centrality of national economic competitiveness. And the language here betrays a kind of mercantilism of the intellect, a fear that the stock of national treasure will be diminished rather than augmented by the success of enterprises elsewhere. It's remarkable, I think, how quickly and easily this language has become naturalized in the past two or three decades, even though it's damaging to the intrinsically cooperative nature of all science and scholarship. The second force is the growing distrust of reasoned argument, now often seen as either a cloak for special interests or a form of elitist arrogance, and a substitution in its place of any kind of indicator that can plausibly be reduced to numerical terms. The latter possess the aura of both precision and objectivity, and so when joined with the assumption about competition, can generate a definitive ranking. Vice-chancellors now keep as nervous an eye on these tables as do football managers. Well, I'll leave that parallel there. Now, in this way, discussion of universities, as of many other matters, has become afflicted with Champions League syndrome. It's assumed that all the top universities play in the same league. I deliberately make the inverted commas intrusive to call attention to the fact that these are very misleading, though familiar, metaphors. National amour-propre, ever a vain and giddy quality, comes to be invested in having universities that might seem to give the big American powerhouses a good game. Once again, the results are principally measured in terms of research in the biological, physical, and medical sciences, and these are, as I said, in turn determined largely by financial investment. Many of the ways in which an institution might be a good university and play an important part in the intellectual life of the host society are simply disregarded. So in Britain, the discussion mostly reduces to whether Oxford and Cambridge and Imperial College are competing with Harvard and Stanford and MIT, and so on. And the question, when these league tables are being discussed, of whether, say, the Norwegian or Swiss higher education systems as a whole serve the needs of their respective populations well, is never asked. I choose the examples at random, not on account of any particular features of those systems. And there is, anyway, no means of translating the answers to such questions into the pseudo-objectivity of tabular form. So the truth is, I think, that the transnational character of intellectual inquiry long predated fashionable talk of globalization and only suffers through the use and belief in these league tables, just as the way in which such inquiry is inherently collaborative ought to give the lie to Kant about international competition. Well, in being invited to speak in this series of lectures, I've obviously been given a pulpit for the evening, so by way of conclusion, I'm going to preach my sermon. As you've heard, I've chosen not to use the occasion to address those issues that currently dominate the headlines about universities, such as funding, or access, or assessment, or any of the other topics that threaten to crowd the intellectual life out of our minds, as they increasingly do out of our conversations. Instead, I want to encourage us to take the long view and to consider our roles as trustees for the present generation of institutions that will long outlive us. One helpful opening move, as I've tried to suggest throughout, may be to consider what it is that we value and admire about good work in scholarship and science, and then to reflect on the conditions which seem conducive to its achievement. Universities are not quite the only places where such work is done, even now, but they unquestionably represent much the biggest concentration of such inquiry. It may be that public discussion of universities sometimes focuses too narrowly on their teaching role, undergraduate teaching above all, seeing them perhaps, as I said, as bigger and more sophisticated sixth form colleges. This role is, of course, central in almost all universities, but it's not the whole story. Major universities are complex organisms, fostering an extraordinary variety of intellectual, scientific, and cultural activity. And the significance and value of much that goes on within them cannot be restricted to a single national framework or to the present generation. They've become an important medium, arguably perhaps even the single most important institutional medium, for conserving, understanding, extending, and handing on to subsequent generations the intellectual, scientific, and artistic heritage of mankind. In thinking about the conditions necessary for their flourishing, we shouldn't therefore take too short-term or too purely local a view. And adopting this wider perspective may also help us to become more aware of the limitations of treating economic growth as an overriding test of value. Taking a longer-term view of the history and indeed the future of universities encourages us to ask fundamental questions of the goal of contributing to national economic prosperity. For example, how much prosperity do we need? And who counts as we? Is it desirable at any cost? What is it in its turn good for? And so on. Any serious attempt to address these questions will inevitably have to invoke non-economic values. Most people, as I suggested, recognise the standing of such values in their own lives. They don't care for their partners or their children in order to generate a profit any more than they admire a beautiful view or a natural wonder because it increases employment. But as I've also suggested, it's become difficult to appeal to such values in a public sphere whose discourse is chiefly framed by the combination of individualism and instrumentalism. Universities are not just good places in which to undertake such fundamental questioning, they also embody an alternative set of values in their very rationale. So whether we're academics or administrators or librarians or support staff or contract researchers or graduate students or undergraduates, I think we all in our way have an obligation to try to hand on to our successors an institution that has managed, through difficult times, to keep alive and embody what is most precious in this particular idea of the university. Organised scepticism is one of its animating principles, that questioning of all claims to truth, no matter how familiar or well-established, and no matter how elevated the academic or political authority who makes them. As I hinted in my opening remarks, and as I hope every student who passes through this university comes to realise, the House of Intellect is in one sense necessarily a democracy. Yes, of course, we have our rituals and our hierarchies, but in the end, across a supervision room or seminar table or lab bench or wherever, the powers that ultimately govern our doings are the better arguments and the better evidence, and it doesn't matter who puts them forward. I did tell you I was going to preach my sermon. So whatever decisions we make in the present about our institutional structures or our funding or our forms of teaching and assessment and the hundreds of other practical things we have to decide about, I think we have no choice but to be committed to handing on to our successors an institution which is still able, across the whole field of human activity, to challenge the current state of understanding, and which is always free to suggest that there are other places to start and other things worth understanding. And keeping that spirit of inquiry alive, really alive, not just paying lip service to it when we put all those lifeless abstract nouns into those life-destroying report forms, but keeping that spirit of inquiry alive is what all of us, in this room, in this university, and in other universities, have to regard as our priority. I should make clear that this does not seem to me a comfortable or easy position. In fact, it's a very radical notion in its way, because it says that we're committed to this kind of freedom of inquiry, come what may. And what may come are not just government directives or other external decisions that we may regard as misguided and even damaging, but an even truer test of our mettle, what may come includes those moral and political values to which we, as ethical agents and responsible citizens, feel a strong commitment. Values which these days often take the form of, for example, ensuring for others a genuine respect and equality of treatment and improvement of life chances, and so on. Those are all hugely important things, but they're not, I submit, the primary and distinctive responsibility of universities, and at times they may even conflict with the prime task of extending understanding. This is not the least of the ways in which the very idea of the university is such an outrageous one. If we are only trustees for our generation of the peculiar cultural achievement that is the university, then those of us whose lives have been shaped by the immeasurable privilege of studying and teaching in a university are not entitled to give up on the attempt to make the case for its best purposes and to make that case tell in the public domain, however discouraging the immediate circumstances. We owe it to those who preserved and enriched the traditions of inquiry which we have inherited, and we owe it too to the generations yet unborn who should not be denied the precious opportunity to wander through the galleries of the human mind with no more fixed purpose than a curiosity to understand how such magnificence came to be and how it can be renewed and extended. A sense of our place in this longer history chastises the petty vanities and foolish crotchets of the present, but it can be inspiring when we reflect that even in circumstances that may have looked to them as little propitious as ours do sometimes to us, no previous generation entirely surrendered this ideal of the university to those ontological fantasists who think they represent the real world. And I deliberately choose there that rhetorical excess because, as Newman, to refer to him for the last time, well knew, such verbal surplus can be the carrier, even though it can never in any straightforward propositional sense be the statement, of the mind's drive for fuller and deeper comprehension, a drive which it is the function of universities to allow to pursue its endless quest without being subject to the requirement to produce some measurable practical outcome in the present. Please do not abandon this idea of the university, however debased you may think any particular manifestation of it has temporarily come to be. Attending to this idea may remind us, amid distracting circumstances, that we are indeed merely custodians for the present generation of a complex intellectual inheritance which we did not create and which it is not ours to destroy. Thank you.